question here is, what are the limits of the evidence? And there are a variety of issues in limits of evidence. One, of course, is how long does the evidence last? We've discussed already the fact that evidence goes away over time. Electromagnetic media fail. We even had a guest lecturer that told you about how electromagnetic media fails, and in fact, and optical media and other media. So in fact, probably you're very discouraged about any case where you need to wait for 3 to 5 years for prosecution. Is anybody aware of any cases that have lasted a long time in the prosecution, or you know, between the time evidence was seized and when the case actually went to court? Sorry? Kevin Mitnick, how long did that case last? Was it 8 years? So if you have a case that's getting on towards 8 years, what do you use for evidence? Yeah, print it on paper, there you go. Print it on acid-free paper. The whole thing. Well, probably only the important parts of the evidence. So how long does it last? How valid is it? Issues of admissibility are important for forensics because the forensics has to do with the legal process. Accuracy and timeliness and the chain of custody issues and so forth. So we want to talk about that. And we've gone through a number of examples. This is an email ransom note example where the records were no longer available for retrieval. If we were going to do the online part of this course, we'd log in and go looking at some audit records. But let's start out with the what can go wrong. And let's see, so the first thing that happens is you show up in the room and you're faced with screens. And we've discussed this before. You take pictures of what's on the screen, you take pictures of the equipment. Now the question comes, should we pull the plug or not? Should we power the system down using a power down, or should we pull the plug while the system is running, or should we turn the system off at all? And there are good points on both sides. There's actually, while I'm at it, I should point out to you some interesting forensics textbooks that you might be interested in looking at. Let's see. This one is called Investigating Computer Crime by Frank Clark and Ken Gilberto. And these guys are both police officers or ex-police officers that worked the computer crime beat for a while. And not just computer crimes, but gathering evidence from computers has to do with every kind of crime. I don't think there's any crime that hasn't been done in a fashion that computer evidence was not involved in it. And they have a wonderful examples of the case studies in here. And I just want to, there's a picture in here on page 4, which is, don't lose my place. But what you'll see there is it's not going to be much clearer if you have more light. You're going to see a whole bunch of wires. And they're all in a piled mess sitting underneath some computer floor somewhere. And this is an example where somebody said, we'll pull the plug, and they pulled all the plugs out of the back of this mainframe computer, turned off the power of this mainframe computer, and grabbed the mainframe computer and hauled it off to the police station. Now, when they did this, obviously the hospital that depended on this mainframe computer for its records related to patient care was unable to proceed in the normal fashion.
Ouch.
So, pulling the plug, I believe that it was very rapidly determined that it would be more advantageous to do this investigation using the computer in a powered on state, being as they didn't have anybody that knew how to take the disk and image them from that mainframe computer, or what to do once they had them. And they would, of course, have to obtain a mainframe computer to put it back on, so there'd be $1 million worth of cost just to do the forensic analysis. So what they did was they returned the computer, and it took, you know, many full-time people with actual expertise several days of effort to put this computer back together and get it into a functioning state. And I'm sure that the medical practice was not happy with this process. So the notion on pulling the plug and doing the imaging the way we've been discussing, where you gather the disk and then you image it to some other disk, has its limitations. I'll give you another example. Suppose you went to some place like Yahoo, where they have, you know, thousands and thousands of computers that comprise the network that answers your questions when you send a question off to Yahoo. Or Alta Vista, which probably has a whole farm of computers, right? It's not probably sitting in one big mainframe. So the question is, when you go there, what plug do you pull? We're going to search Yahoo. So we go to Yahoo and pull the plug on all the computers that comprise Yahoo? Oh, you're going to be nuts. You know, it just isn't going to work. So you need another plan. We want to take evidence off the internet. So let's pull the plug on the internet, right? I guess you could do it, right? Shut down the whole power grid everywhere. And we could pull the plug. And then, of course, we couldn't image it because the power grid would be down. But you get the idea. So generally speaking, if you can pull the plug, that's it's a fine idea. But if you can't pull the plug, you know, you got to be realistic. If you don't know what kind of computer it is, how are you going to know what to do with it? You need to have some intelligence in the process ahead of time. I don't just mean that you have to have your wits about you. I mean that you need to have some information about the environment you're going into before you just go dog nuts and do things. So the question of pulling the plug, now I'm not going to answer the question for you. I'm just going to tell you, you need to answer this question in a reasonable way in real time, which means you need to know what you're doing. Marking it properly is an issue. You saw those cables sitting under the ground there in the picture from that book. Nothing was marked. Right? They just pulled all these plugs out and carried this mainframe, forgetting about the peripherals. Right? You need to mark all those things. Imagine you had a phone switch. Anybody ever see a phone switch in here? We should take you down to the local phone switch. If you have 1,000 extensions, how many wires do you think there are going into the back of that phone switch? Probably it's 1,000 connectors with 8 wires each. Right? So you could probably have 8,000 wires, but so 1,000 connectors. Now if you pull them out and they're not marked, you know, think about this, right? How many tries will it take to plug those 1,000 connectors back in the right order? So you need to mark it, you know, and this is the whole bag and tag technique. You need to mark everything, all the interface on all sides, bring the cords with you, bring the external disk with you, bring the cables with you, bring everything with you. You need to be able to transport it properly. So there's the sensitivity in transport, the shaking, the temperature, the dust, fumes, magnets, and so forth that we've discussed before. There's storage sensitivity, for example, time in storage. I used to have a PC that if you unplugged it from the wall, so if you turned it off, it was no problem. You turn it back on and it has a switch about it. But if you unplugged it from the wall, the battery was no good on the what's supposed to be CMOS. It's not CMOS, but I guess it was no good on the BIOS memory. So if you unplugged it, you had to reconfigure it. And if you didn't reconfigure it properly, well, all right. So first of all, you've lost the settings in the ROM by unplugging it and leaving it unplugged for a significant amount of time because it will retain itself for a couple hours. Next problem is that if you've lost that memory, when you reconfigure it, it may not, for example, recognize all the devices. It might have been a special BIOS configuration. Remember all the devices. Lots of cases where you go to a box and externally, you know, you boot it from a floppy, and you try to access all the devices on the box, and they're not even there. There will be devices that the system does not see because it doesn't know how to access them. They aren't found in the power-up self-test because of the BIOS settings. So if you don't literally physically open up the box and see what's in there and recognize those things that are in there for what they are, you may miss, you know, my 220 gigabyte hard disks that are attached to my Linux box on the inside of the box that when you boot it from DOS, it just doesn't see them. So you could easily miss 40 gigabytes of the data inside that box if you didn't open it. So with time and storage affects these things. Time and storage will make your palm go away and so forth. And storage sensitivities have all the same sensitivities as transport, shaking, temperature, dust, fumes, magnets, and so forth. And also please note that your memory goes down with time and storage. So, you know, let's not count on what you remember. You need to have notes. And the notes have to allow you to put things back together. Analysis errors can go wrong. Not working on the copy, but working on the original. That's a big mistake. Modifying or deleting evidence. That's a bad thing. There might be missing evidence. You examine the disk and you don't recognize all the files. So the file that had the evidence you were looking for was of a type you didn't recognize and you didn't bother to look hard enough. Misreading the evidence. You look at it, you interpret it, you misinterpret it. You saw it wrong, you didn't understand it. Not getting redundant data. I've seen almost every case I've seen, they'll find a little bit of evidence and they'll think they're done. Okay, and they won't bother to look at things like audit trails and file date and time stamps and directory date and time stamps, other accesses and so forth. And not only do you miss a lot of potential evidence, but also you miss the opportunity to find that something was inconsistent or that other things were consistent. And as you can see, that is important in the challenging of evidence. And then, of course, another analysis error is excessive examination. I mean, the fact is, if you spend a year and a half doing the examination, that's probably a little bit too long to spend on any kind of computer you've ever seen. It's unlikely that the investigation is going to warrant all that time. So you need to be efficient at what you seek and what you find. And then, of course, you have presentation errors. Like, for example, talking technical to a jury. Now, most people on juries today are 12 people off the street. So if you go to Livermore, it's 12 people off the street of Livermore are the jury. And if they're technically oriented, then you can bet that the lawyers will try to get them thrown out. It's easy enough to get those people thrown off the jury. So chances are, especially if you're a defense attorney and it's a technical crime, don't you think the defense attorney is going to try and get rid of the witnesses with technical expertise? So you're going to end up with people who don't understand technology. So you need to not talk technically in your presentation. It's another error to not use pictures. Right? You need to create images that make it easy to understand what's going on, what you're saying. If you don't use pictures and you try to explain it with all words, then you get into big trouble. And then another one big mistake people make is denying weaknesses associated with their evidence. If you deny the weaknesses, it's a big problem. Yes, sir?
This slide you talked about is basically a two-edged sword. You're hired by a defendant to dispute the evidence that the police come up with. These are the things you can look for to refute the evidence.
Well, I don't think you can refute the evidence because they talk technical. No. But whichever side you're testifying for, presenting it in a proper way is to your advantage, and talking technical is an error in your presentation. Not using pictures, denying weaknesses. I realize that in court advocacy is the thing of the day, but I think that juries are too smart to let you get away with that. They may not know technology, but if you pick 12 people off the street of Livermore, even though they don't know anything about technology, that doesn't mean they won't be very good at what they do. You go down and pick 10 people off the street of Chicago. They're not techno dweebs, but they can tell the things that when you make sense, they can tell. And if you're bullshitting them, they'll know. And if you're arrogant, they'll detect your arrogance and they'll discredit what you say. And if you think you know everything and you say you think you know everything, they won't like that. It's a little exercise. Called in on a case, they tell you, I have broken into their computer. Their computer is 10.0.0.3. I broke in from the outside. They say from 10.0.0.4, I stole the password file. The question is, what evidence is there? And when we do an exercise on this, you go through the exercise, and if you like, I'll set up an exercise that you can go through to try and determine what happened. Here's a typical scenario. I ran crack on it and guessed the other user's passwords. This is what they're claiming I did. I stole a document called private data, and your job is to look for the evidence, secure it for analysis, and try to determine, is there any evidence? What does it show? What does it trace? Does it trace back to me? And what else do you need? So as a classroom exercise, instead of saying you have 15 minutes, ask questions. If you have them, go. We'll just ask you the question, what would you do? So you have this box. this is the assertion of what happened. So what would you do to look at that box? What would you examine?
Logs.
What kind of logs?
Messages were secure logs to say we came in from the other four, we should get connection from the other four.
Okay, suppose you find a connection from 10.0.4 in that log, then what else do you do?
We're just going to see what user log is.
That's a start. What else?
Access time for the password file. Perhaps I'll record the access.
Anybody else? What time? This is the claim. The defense hasn't had their shot. The defense, when it's their turn, they'll take their turn. Okay, you're trying to say that I did this. The question is, what evidence would you find? Where would you look? If you found somebody, you said we'd look in the log file and see who logged in, who came in over a remote port. All right, so if we're going to look at that log file, where are we going to look for it?
Missing data too. In the event that you erased or modified present log.
How are you going to find the missing data?
There's a steady stream of data. If you find gaps in there that are unusual.
Look for unusual stuff. Okay. That's fine. Looking for unusual stuff is good. They say I ran crack on it from 10.0.0.4.
Does that mean in that case you managed to copy the file back to 4?
So how did I get the file? What evidence would there be of me stealing your password file? How would you find that?
Looking at extra log, 10.0.log.
Look in the logs associated with different services and see whether there were any exploits done on any of those services. Okay? Any other ideas?
Well, if you're connected, when you see the file, when you see this, you can literally copy it down the line. And then, would that actually transfer to that? You would get the stream into something.
Of
course, you can also listen.
If I stole a document called private data, what kind of evidence should there be of that?
That would be an issue of access by your user.
I stole the password file and logged in as a different user.
Private data has certain privileges.
You're missing something real big here.
Make sure that
sure, there is one. There exists a file on 10.0.3 called private data. You've got private data. In fact, it says inside this data is private. Okay, this is what I consider to be a breakthrough in the discussion. So far, nobody's mentioned looking at 10.0.0.4. So clearly, searching the place where they assert that the data went to would be a good move.
So, what is it actually?
know if you don't search it.
I guess you could also check and see if it is record down.
You can search for, this is private data. That string on 10.004. Or other places on 10.003. See whether maybe it had to move somewhere first. I used crack. Claim is I used crack.
You have to read this one first.
No, I say I ran it on 10.004. I stole the password file and I ran crack on it.
Did you run crack on 3.04?
I don't know. That's what, you know, you say I did this. Where do you think I did it? Well, what would be the evidence that I ran crack? What kind of evidence would you look for to try and prove that I ran crack? Means, method, right? And motive, right? Those are the... So you're claiming is that the method I used was to run crack. So for example, might you want to see if the program crack is anywhere on any of these boxes? That would be much better, right? Because then I would have the method available to do it. If I didn't have the method available, I could not have done it. So if you couldn't find crack, and that was part of the case, then I would say you didn't run crack. It didn't exist. That's exculpatory. You didn't find crack on the machine. You say, I didn't look for crack on the machine. You say, look, you searched the machine, right? Right? Did you find crack? No. That's exculpatory. No, but I wasn't looking for it. Well, what do you mean you weren't looking for it? You said that they did this. You didn't even look for it? What kind of investigator are you? Your credibility is going downhill quickly. Your job is to look for evidence, secure it, try to determine, is there evidence? What does it show? Does it trace back to me? And what else do you need? Okay, and I won't reveal the outcome of doing this in the real experimental environment because things get interesting. Other source of evidence, email, in user storage areas. A lot of people, when they search for email, don't look all the places. It's not just that email can be in the user's email file. They might have saved it to some other file and deleted it from their email file. Right? It might be, in the outgoing email sent file area. It might be stored somewhere else on the disk. It might be stored in the infrastructure in between. On servers, an impending mail file. So you send me mail and it's undeliverable as of now. Where's it going to be? It's not going to be on your machine. It's not going to be on my machine. It's going to be somewhere in between us on the infrastructure because it hasn't yet been delivered. Now, there's all sorts of questions about what you're allowed to search under what circumstances that come into this. Problems ensues associated. How about radius logs? These are all things that I have samples of on the system where you do analysis in the lab part of what this course is. So you look at radius logs and you can try and correlate the data on those radius logs to say who had access when to verify that something actually happened. Disk dumps, database transaction records, web and gopher logs, back-end logs for back-end access to databases, email send and receive logs, telephone call logs, ISP logs. Well, you should have gobs of evidence against me. Of course, if all I did was steal private data, chances are you didn't even come into the case anyway. But the fact is, people don't investigate this heavily for such simple crimes. They mostly get away with it. In user storage areas, review my email on the attacker and in my personal email space on servers and attending mail files. For example, /var/bool/mail on most Unix-like boxes will store these mail files, and there are corresponding places in other mail places. If I send it to you, we may both have records, and the combination of records is much better than either one of them. You sent it, I received it. Somebody says, oh, you deleted it. Well, okay, if I deleted it, how come it's not on your system? There were two copies originally. You're saying we both deleted it? That doesn't make sense. So looking for that redundancy is important. And of course, the combination of records is more powerful than either one alone. Here's an example. This is actually a quote from a recent case involving some stock issues. Hope you're buying lots of stock. I'm considering it, unless you have some insider information for me. This is actually in an email sent from one person to another, where the assertion was that the second person who received this sent insider information to the first person. This is right in the email. Now, in this particular case, it wasn't an email stored on the person's personal machine. It was on the email stored in the email server, from which the email was deleted, ostensibly by the person. But deleted email in this particular server technology doesn't actually overwrite the file space. It just says, this was deleted, and someday we won't bother to keep the record. So it was marked as deleted, and someday it might have been overwritten, but not yet, by the time we got it. So if you actually viewed the email records on this particular system, you'd get various conclusions, like, you know, what do you conclude about me as an attacker? Who else is involved? What do their records indicate? Is anything about to happen? Right? A lot of the times, when you do these investigations, you don't only find out about crimes that happened already, because people that commit crimes have a tendency to commit crimes. Right? It's very rare when you find somebody, especially if you can ever catch them, who commits a crime one time and never again does anything criminal. You know, they're walking along the street, the only time in their life they throw a rock through a glass window, then they walk on down the street. That's it. That's the only thing they ever did. It was a crime. It's hard to catch them. They're unlikely. So in most cases, somebody that has committed a crime is a criminal, right? Their job in life, you know, not dissimilar from your job in life, is to do what they do. You know, if you break into computers, that's probably what you do. If you steal from old people, that's probably what you do. If you're into bank fraud, you're into bank fraud. I mean, why take all that time and effort to educate yourself on how to steal money from people and practice the art of theft if you're not going to exercise it? And furthermore, you know, when you don't get caught the first time, people learn not to get caught the next time. If you almost got caught the first time, you'll try to avoid the things that almost got you caught the last time. Okay, whatever your motives are for committing the crime, the motives probably still exist, and there are probably other crimes involved. So when you're looking through these records, you know, then you see things in plain view. Right? In a search, if you're searching for an email, a particular email, and you're looking through a list of emails, and you happen across an email that says, you know, I'm going to shoot you, then excuse me, that's in plain view. You may want to get a warrant to search further, but at that point, I'm going to shoot you, seems to me like that's evidence that we don't want to ignore that just because we're looking for, you know, the jewel thief and we happen across the murderer. Yeah. We don't try to throw that out. So, you know, is anything about to happen? Maybe they tell you about another, you know, we stole that jewelry and we traced down that one piece of jewelry and we're looking through the records of this person and son of a gun, it indicates there's another deal for some other jewelry that we didn't even know he ever stole. So another one is, can you set up to capture live sessions? Okay, you've done an initial search, say out on a server on the internet somewhere with a warrant or for whatever purpose, maybe it's in a corporate setting, you've done it with permission, and you find out that this person's actively involved in these crimes. Well, can you catch him in the act? If so, so you set up maybe to capture live sessions and you get much better evidence, right? You got the photograph of him sitting at his desk, simultaneously we're watching the traffic, he's doing this illegal activity. Here's the records from the other place. Not only that, we picked up the method that's used to do that, and now that we know the whole process, we look for evidence of the other parts of the process and we pick it up. How do you correlate the sessions with the human being? All right, I suggested that you have photographs of them simultaneously. You can't always do that. So coordinating this information, correlating the session with the human being is an important issue. How would you catch me? So we've talked a little bit about this. Radius logs will have start date and time, end date and time, user ID, IP address used, IP address of the originator, which port was used, and lots of other data. I think there are about 100 and some odd fields in a radius log. I mean, yeah, there's a lot of information. An example is searching for all the records for a given user ID. So So basically, you go to the radius log. If you've captured the radius log, if not, you have to get a copy off of the location where it was originally located. And typically, a radius server, you don't want to shut down to image it. Typically, it's not in the possession of the perpetrator. So typically, for the radius log, which is the server that's allowing everybody to log in all day and all the time, you ask the systems administrator to generate you that information, and they provide it to you. And if you need testimony in court, the systems administrator is going to testify that that was a normal business record, and therefore it comes in under the business records exception to the hearsay evidence rules. And then he says, yeah, they're normally taken. It's a normal part of the gathering of information that we have. I provided it to the detective. You know, here's the date and time I provided it to him. I have no reason to believe it's any different than what I sent him. He asked me to retain a copy. I did. Looks the same to me. Okay, that's the nature of that kind of evidence. And so you look at that, and if you want to find a given user, you can do a grep, which is a Unix command, or you can use an automated search routine to search the file. And you can get a listing of every occasion in which that user ID was used. Now, that doesn't mean the human being was at the end of the line, but you can get all this information, and then you can correlate that information. You might do other things. You might find out things like their work pattern. Gee, they always dial in from 2 to 4 in the morning. They always check their mail. They do this. They do that. On Saturday afternoon, it wasn't 2 o'clock in the morning. It was 4 in the afternoon on a Saturday. They've never used it at that time before. They came in, and they did this stuff. Gee, maybe it wasn't them. That's not their normal pattern of activity. Maybe they were trying to conceal something. But something here is unusual. So looking for work patterns. Another one is, along the way, when you do these investigations, you find out other things about the people. Like, for example, in corporations, you find this all the time. You start to look after somebody that you believe has done something wrong, and son of a gun, they're doing lots of things wrong. Like, for example, they're out there all day doing day trading, making stock trades on the internet when they're supposedly, you know, working for the company. Now, if it's an incidental use, then maybe it's not such a big deal, but there are lots of people out there that are doing trading for like 6 hours a day out of the 8 hours they're supposed to be working. And it's not unusual to find out they're a corporate vice president and that they have all sorts of stock investments. And, you know, they're the corporate vice president of finance, so they don't actually know. As we all know, people that high up don't actually have to produce anything, right? So they order other people to produce things, and then they spend the day trying to do stock trades or something. So, you know, you catch people like that, whether you can do anything with them. So this is a side effect of looking at work patterns and usage patterns. So suppose I claim somebody broke in and took over my account. I haven't used it for years. I don't know anything about these attacks. The question is, am I lying? How would you prove that I'm lying? You know, how can the radius logs help you tell whether this person's lying? What else are you going to need to correlate with these radius logs? Okay, these are questions. Start with the answers. Okay, how are you going to tell? You have a radius log. It says I logged in at 2 o'clock on Saturday afternoon. How do you tell whether it's right or not? Okay, go to the phone company. Find out whether the phone numbers were used at that time. Suppose you find my phone was used. Is that good or bad? It's good. Well, what if I happen to be in another city at the time?
Bad.
Right, so you need to correlate that, right? You need to establish that I was there or was able to somehow do that thing. Means. You need to have means and the opportunity. So I need to have the technical capability to do it, and I need to have, you know, the presence in the right place at the right time. And if you can prove those two things, not only with digital evidence, but with other evidence, then the digital evidence becomes harder and harder for me to refute. Especially since you asked me and I said, I've never used it, and you find out that my home number dials it all the time, that's not so easy to say I never used it. I was there, it dials it, there was nobody else in the house at the time. Does it do it automatically? Right, when you search my computer, look, is it an automated routine that just dials at 2 o'clock in the afternoon every day and day trades for a couple hours? Could be my wife. Could be my kids. We'll find out. It's not that unusual for people to have children that use their computers from home, dial into their computer at work, and go out and do stuff. And sometimes those kids break into computers with their parents' accounts. It's not all that unusual. The evidence should tell you this. If you do a disk dump, most of you have seen a disk dump, right? Have you done a DD? So you do a DD, and here's an example of the command for one. One of the first things you notice is like if you do DD space IF equals slash dev slash DD space OF equals slash temp slash test file, you're going to get 640 megabytes of data. So I said, stop, too much data. Try something smaller. So look at a floppy, for example, and look for things like the word help. And can you see the partition table and all the DOS messages? And you can see all sorts of things just by looking at the raw data on a disk. You can see the directory entries, both hidden and deleted, if you look there. Here's an example of a situation where I did a disk dump for the people on the system, and they can go take a look and see what's on there. It's a very nice way to search a disk. It doesn't matter, you know, whether they use some bizarre file system or something like that. It'll search very effectively. Another good place to look is database transaction records. One of the reasons is that databases leave a lot of evidence. A good database will have a copy of every transaction that was done. A bad database won't. So Microsoft Access probably doesn't keep that record of every transaction, but Oracle probably keeps a detail of every transaction that took place. So depending on what kind of database, you have to know what kind of records it takes. So you get details like the user ID, what was done, what records it was done to, when it was done, whether it was successful or failure, and the reason for error, if there are any. And this will tell you, for example, they were trying to access parts of the database they shouldn't have gotten to. It's a very common thing. Whatever's happening out there, I'm not harming anybody. Database records are actually commonly available to the clever user. They're not just available for the investigator, not just available to the systems administrator. And so if the database or records are available to the clever user, does the transaction records reconcile with the database state? So one of the things, some users are clever and they break in and try to alter the data directly without going through the database mechanism. And if they do that, you should be able to tell that the transaction records, the sequential records, do not reflect the state of the database. By checking and correlating between those two, you can very often find that a modification was done to the database directly, and then try and trace down who did it, when, and how. By the process of elimination is usually the way you figure out that this person could have done it, but they had the means, the motive, the opportunity, and you've eliminated all the other suspects. So that's another way to do that. And then there are backups of databases that are often kept for historical records. So depending on how well and how often they use the backup mechanisms, you might be able to find all sorts of things, even if they wiped out the database that records with it, if they think they've wiped it out. And Oliver North is the classic example, right? You guys know about Oliver North's email? You know, you're too young? The Iran-Contra affair, you've heard of that, right? So there was all sorts of evidence of these transactions that they were using the PROS email system to exchange email between Oliver North and other people in the National Security Council. And so Ollie, in shredding his records, besides shredding the paper records, tried to shred his computer records by deleting all the files and deleting with overwrite. Okay, so no problem, because I think on that particular system it said it's overwrite. So he did that, but he didn't realize that they have backups of the email server that they keep all the time and retain. They went to the backups and they found all the emails that went back and forth. And that's one of the ways they caught him. Right? He doesn't have control over that. It's not on your workstation. It's not on your PC. You know, if you're the perpetrator of a crime, it's not on the machine that you're using when you perpetrate the crime. That's not always where the evidence is. It might be somewhere else in the infrastructure, in the supporting stuff. Might be instructive, given a database, because a lot of people believe you can't ever do this. They see this database and they say it's far too complicated. Without the database program, you can never understand it. We all know that's not true. But So you might want to write a program to go and separate the records out of a database, decode the data values, and produce a standard that is a comma-separated, quote, controlled database file, like something that you could then read in from a spreadsheet and print out. And then read it with your with your own database or spreadsheet. And on the sample database, we have a guy named Albert Hellstern. You can go find out about Albert Hellstern and Yang Wang. These are all part of the sort of phony database provided with Microsoft Access that they create to demonstrate the way the product works. And you can probably see deleted records and so forth. Look at web and Gopher logs, and there are a variety of ways to look at these and correlate them with system logs, because typically web and Gopher logs will correspond to the network logs associated with people coming into your computer. And if you try to correlate that and you find missing records in one or the other, that indicates that something went wrong. And then tracking down what went wrong and how is another issue. You might look for things like errors in the user, errors in Netscape logs and so forth. So if Netscape, for example, keeps an error log, if you look at the error log, you'll see people guessing passwords and guessing user IDs. You just see it right in the sequence. And so forth. Sender and recipient times are kept independently in the logs of email, the send mail logs. That's kept separately from the actual emails under the control typically of the systems administrator. So that's a good place to look for evidence. Firewalls. A lot of places now have firewalls in place, and the firewalls have a proxy server that would move stuff through. So you'll find increasingly that there's better evidence in the firewalls than anywhere else because it's well kept and it's secured to a higher level, and the people that run it keep backups and keep audit trails and so on and so forth. And also all the traffic is, they at least try to get all the traffic to flow through there. So it's an increasing priority for law enforcement in this kind of a search to look in the firewalls. They have lots of detail on entry attempts. They may provide the only translations between the inside and the outside, because the internal addresses may not be standard internet addresses. When you get to the inside of a network, the connection between somebody on the inside and somebody on the outside can only be made with the translation table provided by the firewall network, because the firewall is intended to obscure the connection between what happens inside and what happens outside. If you don't, you can't get to that obscuring mechanism, then it might remain obscured. So trying to get past that's important. And from the logs, you can tell a whole bunch of the things about what gets through the firewall and why and what's associated with what and so forth. ISP logs. They're the same as the logs you've been looking at in your computers all the time. Maybe the ISPs will keep some more logs. Telephone logs are similar in a lot of ways to Radius logs, usually involving the same information that you see on a phone bill. Right, somehow the phone company writes your phone bill. Right, that's by audit trails associated with the telephone calls, when they were made, where from, where to, at what time, and what the charge was. So those records are in a computer somewhere. Otherwise they couldn't bill you. You have to be able to look at them and understand what they say. There might also be detailed infrastructure logs. Database usage in telephone systems and so forth. And then there are back-end logs, which are when you access a database through a web server, for example, the web server will have logs. That's the front end. The back end is the database that supports the web server. So there should be corresponding logs on the database and on the web server that tell you what happened, and they'll match with each other. Then we have a lot of other issues like legal challenges, cryptography, embedding and other data formats, tracking over the internet, dealing with anonymity. Generally, the legal challenges, and this course is not as heavy on the legal side as many others are, and I would advise you to read a good book on that, and I can point you to good books, which is, by the way, a good time to flip over to the second book I wanted to tell you about, which is Peter Stevenson's Investigating Computer-Related Crime. And these will be available to look at here after a while. And they talk about different techniques. There's another interesting book that I've just reviewed that hasn't come out yet and so I'll be posting a review of that over to the internet by a guy at Yale. And well, this book will save us a little bit later. legal challenges. First of all, there's jurisdictional problems. Okay, when you're dealing in the internet, and you're a local policeman, and you're trying to search, how do you search, you know, you're in California right now, how do you search something that happened in Iowa? How do you get a warrant to search in Iowa from California? Are you going to fly to Iowa to track down this criminal? You're not a policeman in Iowa. You go to the judge and he says, no, who the heck are you? So you need somebody in the local jurisdiction. Okay, that's California to Iowa. Now, if this went through multiple hops, you might have 5 or 6 different jurisdictions involved.
Ouch.
Right, it starts to hurt. But wait, it gets worse. What if it's international? I mean, you know how hard it is to be international on the internet? Let's see, for $25 a month, I can have 5 megabytes of disk space and CGI-type functionality on a server in Canada. When you use a credit card on my internet site, it's transacted through, you know, some place. I don't know, it might be in San Diego, it might be in Ohio. Suppose it's transacted through Ohio. Now, my U.S. site is actually in Texas. Okay, so the U.S. site that I use for service is in Texas. And the crime might involve email sent from an email vendor who's in Europe, sent to somebody in Africa. Okay, so what we have here is email sent from somebody in Europe to Africa, and the person in Africa went to my website in Texas. And from there, was directed to a transaction which got processed through my website in Canada, and the actual transaction, the financial part of it, got processed through the Ohio financial transaction location. Okay, this is sort of your average fraud over the internet. Meanwhile, I live in California, and my corporation is incorporated in Delaware. Okay? So, you know, first of all, how the heck do you find out that it's me? And second of all, once you know it's me, how are you, you know, what is the proof involved in seizing and searching and analyzing data that's now involving 4 countries, 7 locations? And this is your average internet transaction. This is average. This is not me being obscure or complicated. It just happens to be where the services are provided by the various people that I buy things from to get my job done. Okay, I'm not trying to avoid anything. This is just normal. So this global nature of information technology makes jurisdiction a very serious problem. Most communications are interstate or international. There are very often cooperative agreements. There are all sorts of problems with evidence. Right? You pulled information from some place in Africa on some web server. You gathered it. Now, how does that evidence get in? Right? It's not going to fall into the standard business exception record. And if it does, you're going to have somebody come from Africa and testify. Yeah, we keep these records all the time in our business. So maybe it's from a country that isn't particularly cooperative. So, you know, go to France and deal with the Napoleonic Code, which is the basis of the law there, which is different from the basis of the law here. And try to compel a witness in France somewhere at some ISP to come to the United States for this court date and testify that this is a normal business record that we keep. Through the translator, because he only speaks French. Right? I mean, it's very difficult. Case law is another big legal problem. Like, there isn't enough case law. There haven't been that many cases. So what's admissible, what's not admissible, what's the standard of proof? We don't really know. There just isn't enough case law, especially when you get into these tricky areas where somebody says, yeah, but that's not valid because of this. That evidence is no good. Your expert's not good enough, and so forth. Basically, we're always guessing. Right? We're trying to do the best we can, but we still need to get the evidence and try and prosecute people. In fact, that's one of the reasons that plea bargaining is such a good deal for the police. Not that it saves the courts all the time, but once you show the evidence to the perpetrator, maybe you'll just say, okay, I'll make you a deal. Give me like 2 years for this and we'll ignore these other charges. Or fine me, you know? I'll pay $10,000 in fines. It'll pay for more, twice the cost of your investigation. And you'll never get me the other way. I have good attorneys. It'll cost you a fortune, it'll cost me a fortune. So that's what plea bargaining is for. Qualifications. There are no standard qualifications for expert witnesses in this field. Okay. This isn't medical examiner, right? You go to the medical examiner, if that person doesn't have a medical degree, it's not an MD in working in the medical examiner's office, you know, testimony about the cause of death and the way the death happened, it's not going to get in, right? What are you bringing me, Joe Hokey? Some guy that you, what, you got him off the street? Oh, he has a master's degree in chemistry. That qualifies him to look at dead bodies and tell how they died? I don't think so. So what's the standard qualification for an expert witness in computing? He's the richest guy in the world. Well, that doesn't qualify him as a forensic examiner for computing. I'm sorry, Bill Gates can't get in. What does qualify? There is no standard qualification. Taking this course puts you leagues ahead of the average person who's out there in this evidence. Most of these people are a consultant that somebody knew, maybe the brother-in-law of the guy that worked at the business, who happened to help him configure his computer sometimes, who was invited in to do this. Or some guy from an accounting firm. Okay? So your accounting firm comes in and says, I'm from the, you know, from Dean Witter Stanley Morgan Stern Jones. My name is Bill Buckman, and I work for an accounting firm, and therefore you should accept my expert witness testimony. It's not very compelling. There's no formal qualifications, there's no certificates, there's no formal requirements for training or anything like that. Privacy. It's really hard to get the information you want without infringing on people's potential rights for privacy, and that's so changing these days that it's a very nebulous thing. In fact, at 5:30 today, down at Stanford, they're having an interesting discussion on the privacy issues related to the proposed investigatory capability to sniff traffic on the internet. This is the federal government proposing to watch all the internet traffic. Now, you know, that's laughable, right? How can you possibly hope to watch all the internet traffic in my house? The federal government probably couldn't hardly watch the network traffic in my house. Certainly not in this facility, and certainly not in the Bay Area. There's just too much of it. So, but they're going to debate the privacy issues, which are extreme, right? You're watching this traffic. You essentially have a phone tap. Okay, your phone tap is now tapping not only because of the shared infrastructure, it's not only tapping the data from Bill's phone to Mary's phone. It happens to also be tapping all of the information that goes from anywhere inside X company to anywhere on the internet. And what state are we in? We're in California right now. This is a two-party consent state. You need consent of both parties to a telephone call to tap it. Who the heck are the two parties? You're sniffing internet traffic. This is like everybody in the world would have to consent, because potentially at any given moment you're talking to anybody out in the world. So how do you differentiate that? The privacy issues here are extreme, and of course the law hasn't gotten around to this yet. So will this evidence be admissible or not 2 years from now? Nobody knows. Search warrants. All right, so there's the validity associated with broad searches is a problem. I say I want to search this computer for evidence of this homicide. You start searching, you come across child pornography. What do you do now? Oops, we're looking for a homicide. We found a picture of a young lady that seems like she could be a child. Now what do we do? Well, you might go back for the warrant. Say, well, Your Honor, you know we were searching for that murder. We happened to cross child pornography evidence. Here's the piece of evidence we happened to cross. It was valid because it was in plain sight. That is, we didn't look for that particular evidence. We're looking for this other evidence. We happened to see it. just like we were searching his filing cabinet for evidence, and there happened to be a naked picture in there. And now we say, Your Honor, we want to continue the search, but since we've also found out it was another crime, we'd like to search for that too. We can go back and get another warrant, and as you search through that file cabinet, you might find a lot of crimes. So the validity of those searches become in question, especially depending on what your warrant says and what the judge signed. What can you really look for? And what do you ask for? Right? When you go in to search, you say, I'm gonna seize this computer and I'm gonna search it. If your warrant says I'm gonna search for email, and you find something else, and it wasn't email, that's not gonna get in. And all the evidence that follows behind that's not gonna get in. Anything that was based on that non-email thing you found. So what you have to ask for is the right stuff. And of course, you wanna try to ask for as much as you can ask for. Of course, if you ask for too much, and the judge grants it to you, the defense attorney later on will say, sorry, that was too broad. Of course, there are plenty of cases where the defense attorney also can't bring in evidence because it was beyond the scope of what was involved in the search. So I might have found some exculpatory evidence that would say that your client's innocent, but couldn't get in because my search warrant didn't meet the criteria. So my evidence doesn't get in for what I found, but neither does the defense's evidence get in for what they found. Which tells you that the legal system tends to be more wrapped up in the legalities than in actually figuring out whether somebody did something wrong or not. And there are cases where there was evidence that would have been exculpatory and people have been, you know, successfully prosecuted and found guilty, even though there was evidence that said they're not guilty, because the evidence that said that they're not guilty was found by the prosecutor, but it was found in an illegal search. So it couldn't get in. Which, you know, I guess I'm not the judge, right? So expansion is you learn more. As you do the search, you learn more, and you need to expand the scope of your search, which means you need to expand the scope of the warrant. And this process creates all sorts of legal challenges. Permission is the other kind of search, and permission searches require an agreement. So if I'm going into a company and I'm going to do a search, and I have the permission of the company, that doesn't necessarily mean I have the permission of the employee of the company whose information I'm searching. And so, an employee and an employer need to have an agreement in place. So if you're an employer, you need an agreement that specifies that you have the right to search all this stuff for any or no reason, and that agreement follows the various requirements of the law. So you might want to look at your agreement and see what you're actually allowed to follow. And there's notice as a requirement of a lot of these things. Also, if you're in a private investigation, and you do a search, and the company says we have an agreement, and it turns out they don't have an agreement, you may be found guilty of wiretapping, which is a felony offense. You can get thrown in jail for working for a company that said they have an agreement with the employee but doesn't actually have an agreement with the employee. And I'm not talking about getting the evidence thrown out. I'm talking about you go to jail. You get arrested and thrown in jail, and they search your computer to find the evidence of the tapping that you did in a contract for this company. So there are risks. There are also privileges associated with searches. Anytime you're going to search stuff, there's privileges associated with doctors, lawyers, and clergy. So if I email stuff to my attorney, and you're searching my email, and you happen across confidential client-attorney communications, ouch. That's potentially a big problem. Can you search further? How do you avoid now revealing all this confidential information and still search the computer? That becomes a potentially serious problem. And then we have the issues of cryptography and steganography. Cryptography is the art of secret writing. That's a way that you obscure information. Steganography is placing data as if it was noise inside other data. Okay, so in cryptography, you find some way to write something down to keep it secret, like encoding it with some key or some such thing. And when they try to keep it secret, you try to get the secret. With steganography is typically hidden as bits within pictures. So I might take a picture, and in the low order bits, I might encode a message by, you know, sticking the bits of my message as, for example, the last bit in every 17th byte in this photograph. The photograph will still look just the same. Okay, if I use compression and cryptography in affiliation with steganography, it will be very, very difficult to detect that there was actually steganography put into this picture. And of course, I can still extract the data out. It's typically done at below the normal noise threshold so that when you look at the picture, it looks right. Strategies for cryptography, legal moves to force the keys. You say, look, this evidence is encrypted. You give us the keys. The judge has ordered you to give us the keys. You get a court order. If he doesn't give you the keys, he goes into jail and waits for the keys. So if you get a right judge in the right circumstance, you might be able to get somebody tossed in jail for refusing to provide the keys to law enforcement because the judge ordered it. That doesn't happen very often, but it's something that can happen sometimes. You can use technical attacks on the system. And you might want to read the article at all.net under the 50 Ways series, titled 50 Ways to Defeat Your Public Key Inter PKI or Another Crypto System, something like that. So that'll describe a variety of technical attacks on systems. Another one is you convince them to give the key or information that leads to the data. Right? You're sitting in the room and you find some evidence of the crime, you say, look, we found this, you're already flush. You know, you're going to jail. Now, frankly, I don't think this is that bad a crime. I don't want you to go to jail for a long time, but I see you have these encrypted files, and I want you to give me the keys to these encrypted files, or else I'm going to find every piece of evidence I can in this box, and we're going to make sure you go to jail for as long as we possibly can for every picture in the box. I want to be your friend. Or there's good cop, bad cop. There are a variety of techniques. I've already mentioned the bring them into the room and say, do you know why you're here? Strategy. Do you know why we're here today? And the answer is it's the VCRs I stole. Now you are actually looking for a pornography case and you find out this is grand theft. Come on. Ooh. And you say, that certainly is part of the reason that you're here.